Everybody ready? Come on, let's go. The Reed Fun Show! Let's go! The Reed Fun Show! Let's go!
Yo, what's up? This is Rick Thorne. Welcome to The Rick Thorne Show. On this episode, I got my good friend. I've known him for a long time. He's like, man, the jack of all trades. We're talking comedy. We're talking music. We're talking running labels. We're talking hosting shows. What up, Joe Sib? What are you doing?
What up, Rick? How are you, buddy?
I'm good, dude. I'm like, how are you?
Oh, dude. It couldn't be better. I'm down staring at the surf right now. There's waves. After I'm done talking to you, I'm going to paddle out and hopefully get some waves, man. It's killer right now.
Oh, wait, you surf?
End of summer.
You surf too?
Yeah, dude.
I got to bring my daughter out with you, bro.
Oh, yeah. I just got back from Northern California, surfed Santa Cruz for 3 days. It was killer. And basically drove down the coast, got back down south last night, and there's a swell. Little swell, some action in the water, and I'm gonna paddle out. I'm stoked.
Wait, so you're from Santa Cruz, huh?
Yeah, I grew up in Santa Cruz. My parents moved there. They moved there in like early 70s, and they were both from the East Coast. My mom is from Philly. My dad's from New York. They met on the East Coast, decided they wanted to, you know, change it up, came out to the West Coast, and we all came together in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And which was a trip because I'm so not a mountain guy, but my parents were like, you know, they were young and they wanted to have horses and, you know, I always say they were ahead of kind of everyone with getting off of the grid. They wanted to, you know, have their own, they had like their own well with water. My dad was a teacher at the university that was near there. So it was a super cool, chill vibe. And I grew up out there with my sister, and then my parents ended up splitting when I was around 10 years old, and my mom moved into Capitola of Santa Cruz, and my dad moved about 35, 40 miles further inland to San Jose. So that's kind of how I got to San Jose to ultimately, you know, meet Caballero and Corey O'Brien and Gavin O'Brien. That's kind of how, in a weird way, like I ended up meeting you because, you know, I moved to San Jose when I was about 15 years old, and that's why I just dove headfirst into skating. I'm kind of going all over the place right now. Sorry.
No, you're good. That's why I love you, and that's why I like talking to you, because it's easy. Like, it's fun. Like, yeah. I like talking to people that are fun, that, like, kind of take it all over the place. You got into punk rock after you moved to San Jose? Like, is that like you got into that scene more? Because Santa Cruz has
totally.
A pretty rad skate scene too, though, don't they?
Oh, God. Totally. For me, it's funny. I never surfed in Santa Cruz when I was younger because it was just too gnarly back then. It was like, you know, the dudes that hung out at the Point and, you know, the Cove and 26th Avenue and all the spots that I kind of was, you know, hanging out as a kid before I moved to San Jose. It was just, I just saw a lot of just not very friendly behavior in the water. And not that it was, you know, that it wasn't justified because, you know, there'd be a lot of people that, you know, acted lame in the water, and, you know, the people in Santa Cruz just had to just shut that down immediately. I mean, back then it was just like you would get, you know, if you were someone that came into a break that you weren't a local at, I mean, you got schooled really quick. And you know, seeing that, I think as a kid, I just was like, man, how am I going to get good at a sport if I have to worry about, you know, getting in someone's way that might, you know, punch me in the face, you know. So that's how I got onto a skateboard, because with skating, you know, I felt way more in control, you know. And in Santa Cruz at that point, like I said, I was probably about 12 or 13. You know, I was into skateboarding, but I didn't really go to the next level of realizing like that was going to be something that was really going to put me in the direction I'd follow for the rest of my life until I moved in with my dad. And when I went over to visit my dad in San Jose, you know, I'd go with him on the weekends, and, you know, at that point, you know, he was probably in his late 30s, you know, so he's just kind of like, all right, what am I going to do with my son this weekend? And he knew that I, you know, had a skateboard, and he goes, hey, man, I saw this week there's a skateboard park by my house. I was like, really? I'm like, wow, I've never been to anything like that. He's like, you know, I'll take you. And I remember, you know, we drove to Winchester Skateboard Park, and at the time, you know, I'd never seen that many skateboarders in like one zone, you know.
Right.
And when I showed up, yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's like, it was like, up until that point, I thought like I was really, me and like three friends were into it. But at this point, it's the early 80s, I'm in seventh grade, and it was a real turning point because when I showed up at the skateboard park, I was like, wow, man, check out all these dudes. You know, this is rad. You know, there's a full crew of kids there. And it just ended up that it was so close to my dad's house that it really became my second home, and I just would go there every weekend. And it went from me going there, like, you know, all right, I'll go for like a couple of hours, to literally I spent a whole summer with my dad where he would drop me off at 8 in the morning and he would come and pick me up after work at 6, 5, and then say, hey, man, you know, like, come home for dinner. And then as soon as I finished dinner, he just, you know, he would see that look on my face, and he'd be like, you want to go back to the park? And I'm like, yeah, Dad, because, you know, the night session's going to happen. And in the summer, you know, it was so hot, so it was like all the heavies, they wouldn't skate during the day. All the, you know, groms like me would skate during the day because there's no one there because it's 105 degrees. But at night, when it cooled down, all of a sudden, you know, all the Rick Blackhearts, Bob DeKnight, gosh, who else? You know, Caballero, Norman Toon, Corey O'Brien, Gavin O'Brien, all the, you know, this guy named Insco, just all these guys that ripped. They would show up right around 6:37, and then it would go till about 10 o'clock at night, and I would just, you know, so I was literally at the skate park from 8 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night every single day, and I just, like, it was my life. I loved it. I loved it so much, and that was how I met Cab, and, you know, he just happened to be our home park guy. So it was pretty rad. You know, I always say, like, it's like growing up with, like, I don't even know any other sports, but it'd be like if you were bros with, like, Tiger Woods or something, and you're like, yeah, dude, he's, like, into golf, and it just, you know, he happens to be the best. Or if you were, like, into basketball, and you're like, you know, I don't know, like, Magic Johnson was your bro. And you're like, yeah, dude, my bro next door plays basketball.
What's no, well, that's what happened to me, actually, to interrupt you real quick. I grew up with, in Missouri, with my best friend is Dennis McCoy. And Dennis McCoy, he was the first BMXer ever sponsored outside of California. He went out to Venice, and beat everybody. And everybody's like, who is this guy? And that was my best friend I've known since 12, you know, since I was about 12 years old. And to me, it was like, oh, yeah, that's my bro Dennis. But what was cool about it was being around him, I learned so much and got inspired so much to follow the same path to a degree. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm gonna do that because I'm seeing all this stuff. I'm like, what? So did you feel that way, like, around Cab and all that, and like in the scene and music?
God.
Like,
well, I didn't become friendly with him until later, because when I met him, you know, I met him right when he was still amateur. And when I say I met him, you know, I met him, like, you know, we would be in the park together, and I would just, you know, I was a little kid, so I'm a few years younger than him, so I would, you know, I was there. I saw him, you know, I saw Stacy Peralta come and watch him skate at Winchester. I'll never forget it. You know, he was up on he had this viewing deck, and I remember I was skating the Clover Bowl, and Stacy showed up, and I don't think Cab was there yet, and he was just kind of waiting, and he was up on the deck, and I'm like, holy shit, that's Stacy Peralta. You know, even at 13, I was like, I know who fucking that guy is. And, you know, at that point, you know, Cab shows up, and obviously Stacy and him start hanging out. He was already sponsored, but my point being was it was San Jose turned into this real mecca of skateboarding. And at that moment when I met Stevie, I just more, you know, he was such a force, and he was always cool, but I didn't really get to know him and be friends with him until I started playing music. And once I started playing music, he was in a band, I was in a band, and then at that point, you know, when he was in the faction, you know, I started going to shows. I was there for the, you know, first time they opened for Social Distortion, you know, 1982. I think that was their first show they ever did. I was there for that. And then later on, you know, from the Winchester being, you know, say like 12, 13 years old, now I was like a sophomore in high school. And I had my own band, and, you know, I was heavily involved in punk rock. So I think at that point he was like, oh, shit, you know, like, that's that dude from the skate park. And then we kind of, you know, I remember once I rode with them, you know, to see the Exploited together. You know, we all went up to the San Francisco together, and they had this van that the faction drove their gear in. So I went with them there, and then, you know, started seeing Cab more out. And then once the park had already closed, and there was just a lot of ramp skating, you were just always coming in contact with Steve. And the thing that I always loved about Steve, though, was, like, he never, like, he was such a force. And at that point, he was such a legend already. But I don't know, he never carried himself that way, like, around the bros from San Jose. Like, he never carried himself in a way that, you know, he checked himself all the time. I don't know. I just never got a feeling from him. Like, I would see him, you know, at a punk show where, you know, maybe he wasn't the most known dude because it was punk rock. But then I'd see him skating, and he was always super cool. He's never, like, wavered one way or the other. Like, he's always been such a good guy, you know, such a solid guy. And then as we got older, and, you know, and I met you, and we started, you know, touring on the Warped Tour, and I was out there with 22 Jacks, and him and I reconnected. I think we bonded over the fact that we just both were like, are we really in Australia together? And you're from San Jose, and I'm from San Jose, and like, this is nuts, you know, like, this is crazy. Like, look, you know, like, you kind of look around, and you're all, wow, man, it's only you and I from San Jose that are on this bus touring the world. And I think that was super cool. Him and I bonded over that. And I just remember, like, you know, I remember, like, just fast-forwarding to touring on the Warped Tour together. And, you know, you guys all riding the ramp. I remember every, you know, when 22 Jacks was on the tour, I remember so many times, like, yelling up at Stevie, and he'd be on the ramp, and, you know, there's like there's like 1,000 people watching him skate, and he's doing a demo, and I would yell up there, like, I'd be like, yo, dude, do a sweeper. You know, and a sweeper is like a trick from the 80s, you know, and he would do it. He'd be like, all right, you drop in and, like, blast the frontside invert, blast the huge backside air, and then do a sweeper, you know, and I was, you know, I don't know, I always just love him, and, you know, and not to turn into this, why Steve Caballero, like, for people listening, they're like, dude, did Stevie die? Like,
no.
It's like, what I'm saying is, like, you know, he's such an inspiration on so many different levels, and you know, even now, down to him breaking his femur, dude, I mean,
I know.
Riding motorcycles, breaks his femur, and then I see him on Instagram the other day riding a bike, I'm just like, this guy is just...
Yeah, but
like,
there's something that you and him have in common, as well as me with both of you.
What's that?
Is you're diversified.
Tell me.
No, you're diversified, bro. Like, for real, like, to talk about you and your accomplishments, check it out, bro. You do comedy. You've been in successful punk bands. You ran a record label. You started a record label. You've hosted radio shows. You're multi-talented. Like, you know, it's not like you do one thing. You know, like, you're able to do a number of different things. I mean, you were talking about the punk bands. I want to talk about your bands. Before I get into your comedy is what I really want to talk about, but I got to lay the foundation here. I want to talk about your bands, 22 Jacks and Wax. Before I met you, I saw a music video of a guy running on fire in slow motion. My old friend, Spike Jones, directed that. So I'm like, anything Spike did that came out on TV, on MTV, we're like, what is this band? It's got to be rad if Spike's involved. It was always that vibe. And that's how I found out about Wax. Later, I found out that you were in Wax when I met you in 22 Jacks, right? So talk to me about Wax real quick, dude. How did that, what year was that?
You know, the funny thing about the whole connection with Spike is it all, like, once again, like I said, you know, a few minutes ago, it all comes down to skateboarding, because the only reason I knew Spike was we were skating a curve together on Melrose Avenue. I remember it was like an Arco. I think it's still there. So I was there with the dudes in Wax, and there was a dude skating a curve, and I was skating the curve, and then there, it was Spike, and I started talking to him, and the guys in Wax were like, "Oh yeah, Spike's a photographer. Spike's cool, and you know, if you know Spike, he's not like a super talkative dude, you know."
No,
and we were just, but you know, super cool. But, like, you know, we're just skating together. And then as Wax kind of got more and more going along, it was like, hey, we need photos of the band. Oh, dude, let's get our bro Spike. And then all of a sudden, Spike's taking photos for everyone. And then all of a sudden, Spike's working for magazines. And all of a sudden, it's like, hey, man, we need to make a video. And Spike had been doing stuff with skate videos. Hey, let's have Spike do a video. He did the first video he ever did was for the band Wax. But it's not the Guy on Fire video. It's this video. It's called Hush. And you can check it out, you know, Wax, the name of the song is Hush. And it's the first video I ever did with Spike in when we were in Chicago, and our manager was like, hey man, who was tight with Spike, we should have Spike direct the video. We were like, fuck yeah. You know, like, it wasn't even like, oh dude, I need to see what he did. It was just like, oh yeah, Spike's doing videos now. Yeah, let's have him direct our video. And the first music video he ever did was for us. And then, of course, from there, he started doing, you know, the Breeders, and then from the Breeders to Weezer, and it just, he just fucking blew up. You know?
He did. And you know what? You know what he started before the skating? Well, you know how he started before skateboarding, right? He was the number one photographer on BMX. He did.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah. Like, dude, I mean, it's a different story, but for the sake of saying, Dennis, like, to backtrack, Dennis was my best buddy. I mean, he still is. And he got a letter from Spike as fan mail saying, "Hey, I'm Spike Jones. I ride BMX. I'm from the East Coast. I'm a big fan of yours." And so this is before Spike was even a photographer for BMX. He was a BMXer. And so he built his way up into the through the BMX world of photography, you know, like with Go Magazine and I think Freestyling, and then Go, and then he did Dirt Magazine with Jeff Tremaine and all those guys now that, and then that turned into Big Brother and et cetera.
Yeah,
so his roots have been very deep. So when I saw, like, you know, the first video I saw with Wax was the guy running on fire. What's the name of that song?
Yeah.
California?
California.
Yeah,
California,
okay.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I was like, oh, what the hell? And like, so it was like anything Spike was involved with, that was old blood for us. That we were like excited for him that he was doing all this other stuff. And
I remember Dirt Magazine too, because, you know, that was right around the time I kind of met Spike. You know, it's like at that point, you know, he's doing photos for skating, and then he started Dirt Magazine. I remember him and Andy Jenkins and those dudes had Dirt Magazine, and they go, "Hey man, we're gonna film a commercial that they're gonna air on ESPN." And it was like, I was already in Wax and stuff, and Spike's like, "Yeah, we want you're gonna be the guy in the commercial." And I remember we shot it down on Larchmont in LA, and it was like, I'd never been in a commercial before, and then all of a sudden it was this commercial airing for this new magazine. I didn't even know what Dirt was, because Dirt hadn't even happened yet. And all of a sudden, people were coming up to me and they're like, "Dude, I saw this commercial with you, you know, for Dirt Magazine where you're selling magazines," because I was like a sales guy in it. And it was like the first time that, like, you know, that, like, you know, I remember I show up to film this commercial. I'm just thinking, like, you know, it's not like it is today where you're like, "All right, we'll set up, you know, our iPhones and film it." It was like, dude, full set, and Spike was in charge, and it was sick. And then, you know, of course, later on when we did the Guy on Fire video, I mean, by that point, you know, he had done so many videos, and he was just so huge at that moment.
Yeah, the buzz was out, and he's a good dude, and he's definitely creative. So we have a connection.
So
there.
Creative.
Yeah, and then talk to me about 22 Jacks. That's when we were in Australia on the Warped Tour, like, what, around like 99 or something like that, 98, 99.
Yeah, because you remember we were down there when we were, you know, we were going to be in New Zealand, where it turns, that's the first place in the world that, like, on New Year's Eve is the first day. So, like, Kevin Lyman had this idea of, like, we're going to be on the road in New Zealand. So we were down there from, you know, on 2000. And then,
yeah, that was the Y2K. They're like, "Oh my God, Y2K, everything's going to shut down. Ah, Y2K.
Yeah. So crazy. Everyone thought the world was going to end, you know?
They've been saying that forever, though, haven't they? Haven't they been saying the world's going to end forever? Like, you know?
Yeah, dude. Dude, people, there's, I guarantee you that supposedly the world's supposed to end today. Like, there's people that think it's going to end today. And I remember though, we were all down there, and it was like, I remember, you know, we had done the U.S. Warped Tour a ton of times, you know, and done shows there. And, you know, I met you out there, and obviously Cab was out there, and everyone was out there. And then when 22 Jacks, like, the thing that kind of was different about that band was, you know, when my band Wax ended, you know, I was in this weird place where, like, when you're a singer and your band ends, you're kind of on, like, unless you're a dude that has a guitar, or, like, you know, you're Dave Grohl, and you're like, "Yeah, dude, I'm a multi-talented musician." You're kind of in a weird place where, like, if you don't have a band to play with, then you're not going to play any music. And I got super fortunate, because at that moment when Wax, you know, fell apart, one of my best friends, Steve Soto, was like, "Hey, dude, we've always talked about starting a band together. Like, now's the time. Let's do this." And I remember I'm like, "Fuck, that'd be rad." Like, I've known Steve since I was a little kid. I'm such an adolescent fanatic. You know, let's do this. And him and I started writing songs together, and we never really anticipated that, you know, it would kind of turn into what it did. And then we were like, "Well, we got to find other guys to play with." And it just ended up that, I'd been in L.A. long enough that with 22 Jacks, I was like, "Hey, you know what, I'm going to ask my buddy to play guitar, who plays No Use for a Name, and that was Chris Shiplett. And it was like, oh, wow. You know, like, Chris is like, I'll play guitar. And then it was like, Chris's brother, Scott Shiflett, ripping bass player. He's in Face to Face. And me first in Gimme Gimme. He's like, I'll play bass. So all of a sudden, I got those two guys. And then Sandy Hansen from The Adolescents was like, well, dude, if Steve's doing it, I'll do it. So I have Sandy on drums. I got Soto on guitar, Chris Shiflett on guitar. And then I got, you know, Scott Shiflett on bass. So all of a sudden, I just got this stellar band. And then as far as, like, writing went, you know, I kind of went, and at the time, I just was like, I'm going to write songs with, like, all the people I've ever, like, dug, you know, and toured with when I was in Wax that I was just friendly with. And, you know, one of the guys was, like, Jason Cropper, who he had a similar experience to me. He got kicked out of his band. So, you know, him and I kind of bonded over that. He was in Weezer. He was the original guitar player in Weezer. And so him and I, you know, we were super tight, and I wrote songs with him, and then I wrote songs with Soto, and then my old bandmate from San Jose, Bill Franza, I wrote songs with him, and I just started writing all these songs, and we recorded this first record called Uncle Bob, and we put it out, and that was like one of the first records on Side One Dummy, and I was kind of like at that point where like I had started the record label Side One Dummy with my partner Bill Armstrong, but like we really didn't have any bands yet, so Bill and I were like, well, let's put 22 Jacks on Side One. It was like, that was a no-brainer, and then
wait,
put the record out.
So you had Side One Dummy before or right when you started 22 Jacks?
Well, I mean, I had Side One, but like, see, I was living, God, for someone listening to this, I apologize if you're like, dude, Rick Thorne had Joe Sib on there, and the guy was talking in poems around Rick. The way it kind of worked was this. So I'm in Wax. And I'm living in L.A., and Wax is three dudes from Chicago and me. That's kind of where, you know, you meet Spike Jones, and you meet all these guys. Wax ends up having a really, really great run. But what ends up happening is, you know, as it does with bands, you know, we ended up falling apart for stupid reasons, you know. And at that point, I was like, man, you know, I got to figure out something to do. So I started 22 Jacks, but at the same time I started 22 Jacks, I was living with my partner, Bill Armstrong. We were roommates. And he was thinking of starting a label. I had already kind of started one with Wax, you know, like done a few 7-inches. But we didn't really, you know, nothing was, like, set. And then what ended up happening was Bill and I were like, dude, we should do this together because, like, you know, we live together, we drink together, we're best friends. And if you start a label and I have a label, that'll suck. You know, he's like, you're right. So that's how you get Side One Dummy, because I had Side One, and he was going to start his company called Dummy. So we're like, dude, let's just put it together, and we'll call it Side One Dummy. That way, if it doesn't work out, you take Dummy, I take Side One, we're cool. Well,
oh,
you know,
that's
25
cool.
years later.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, 25 years later, it worked out.
Yeah, it worked out grad, too. I mean, what are some of the bands that you've had on Side One Dummy?
Oh, man, I mean, well, you know, like, the first band was 22 Jacks, and that was super cool because, you know, it took off pretty quick. But at the same time, I was in the band, you know, Bill and I were always like, you know, we weren't really, you know, honestly, we weren't selling any records. Like, it was hard because at that point, you know, Epitaph and Fat, that was the go-to label. Like, that's where everyone wanted to be. And, you know, I've always said this, you know, the thing that Fat and Epitaph had to offer that I didn't was that, you know, if you were on, you know, you could go on tour. Brett Gurwitz could bring you on tour with Bad Religion. You know, Fat Mike could bring you on tour with No Effects. You know, we couldn't offer bands that. So it was super hard to get bands to want to be, I think, on Side One just for that fact, because they were like, dude, I love you and Bill, but damn, dude, like, we need to get on tour, and Brett's going to take us on tour with Bad Religion if we sign to Epitaph. So, you know, at that moment, Bill and I were like, damn, dude, we got to figure this out, you know, and we needed to find a band that would sign with us. And the first band that took a shot with us because they needed the opportunity and we needed it, and it was just perfect timing, was Swaggy Molly. And, you know, Bill and I went, signed them. Gosh, man, I mean, everyone had passed on them. And
oh, really?
We were like, man.
Swaggy Molly.
Oh, my God,
yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, they didn't, because you got to remember, dude, this is like, you know, Dave King at this point, you know, he's not a young kid, and, you know, they're playing this, you know, like, Dropkick Murphys weren't Dropkick Murphys at this point, and and Celtic punk rock music and banjos and accordions. It was like, what? Like, how?
What year? What year was that? Like 98 or something?
You know, this is, I would say, 97, 98, something like that. You know, I don't know. I think we put out Swagger, you know, I think Swagger came out like, you know, probably around, you know, probably, gosh, 98, something like that.
Yeah, because I saw Flogging Molly at this book signing or this book release that my buddy wrote this book in 1997. And the reason why I remember, well, they're Flogging Molly for one, but I also knew that Matt Hensley was in that band and he was a pro skater.
Oh yeah.
And I always I didn't really know Matt, but I liked his style, and I saw them play at this little club in 97. So that's why I'm thinking they probably weren't signed. They were new. And then you guys, yeah, that's rad. So then by signing them, just people were like, oh, did you feel like they took the label more serious because you had Flogging Molly?
Oh, totally. I mean, dude, not even kind of. It was like the release date for Swagger. I'm just looking at it right now. It says it came out in 2000.
Got it.
So we started working. We started working with them in 2000. So at that point, you know, the label, you know, no one knew. It's just like, it's like skateboarding. It's like BMX. It's like, you know, a label is your sponsor, and at this point, no one really knew if we could do what we said we were going to do. You know, people were like, you know, we'd been a label since 95. We'd been around for 5 years, and we really hadn't had anything stick yet. But when we signed Flogging Molly, Swagger came out, and that band was a touring machine. And then, you know, right from that into Drunken Lullabies, and it was on, dude. I mean,
right.
It was just like, it was, and it also showed, you know, all of it had to do with Flogging Molly. I mean, like, you know, you can't be a label and go, oh, yeah, dude, we were the ones that made them happen. That's not even the case. Like, the case is they were an amazing band, and we didn't fuck it up. That's all, you know, that was just it. We didn't fuck it up. We knew how to make sure we could harness the momentum that band had, because you got to remember, they were on the road nonstop, and so many bands have that problem where they sign to a label and the band is working so hard, but the label, you know, messes up. They screw up. They drop the ball. And we were ready to not have that experience.
They screw up by ripping them off. Is that what you're saying?
I don't even know about ripping them off. I mean, there's no shortage of stories of labels ripping bands off, and you know, that's a whole other podcast.
Right.
But I think there's also a lot of labels. And, you know, I'm not just saying this because I'm the guy in the label end, but a lot of labels, you know, you start out with great intentions. You know, so many labels came out, you know, there's people that are like, hey, I was a musician. I want to have a better place for musicians. And everyone starts out with this great common goal of a label written, you know, of a label for artists, by artists, and everything starts cruising along. But then what ends up happening is a lot of times, you know, and this was kind of something that, you know, we steered clear of, is that it is business, you know, and it can't be bro deals, and it can't be just like, hey man, sign to the label, smoke a joint, handshake, it's all cool. Like, we have heard horror stories from people that had done deals and they weren't, you know, I hate to say it, they weren't done with paperwork, and no one really knew where they were in their deal, and no one knew what they were getting paid. And I have to give a lot of credit to my partner, Bill, because Bill was very, very conscientious of, hey, man, if we're going to do this and we go out of business, I'm fucking cool. But what I don't want to do is go out of business because we didn't pay people. Like, that's not cool. I want to be able to. I remember, you know, the number one rule was we have to pay everybody. And you know, the hardest thing with Side One Dummy was, there's so many bands I signed that, you know, when you sign a band, you only want the best for the band. You want them to be huge. You know, you're like, gosh, dude, it's on. Like, here we go. And then the heartbreaker is when it doesn't go big. It isn't a Flogging Molly. It isn't a Go-Go Bordello. It isn't a Gaslight Anthem. It isn't a Jeff Rosenstock. It isn't, you know, a pup. I mean, it's no different than like an athlete. Like, yeah, man, my bike was going to come out, or my deck was going to come out and do better, and it didn't. For some reason, people don't want to buy it. And that's the hardest thing, because there's no shortage of bands that work so hard, and for one thing or another, their art and music doesn't connect like other people's. And I wish that I knew the secret mix that made that happen. But just, you know, there's Flogging Mollies, there's Gaslight Anthems that just, for some reason, you know, it just resonates with people, and you know, they work hard, and it just connected in such huge ways.
Yeah, that's rad. But, yeah. Dude, that's great, dude. That's, I mean, you guys.
But, you know, it's hard, though. You know, it's hard because it's, I think, you know, for me, you know, I was never, you know, I was in Wax, I was in 22 Jacks, and, you know, we had a good run. But, you know, I never, as a guy in a band, you know, I never experienced the popularity and the magnitude of bands like Flogging Molly and Gaslight Anthem and Go Gabardello and Puff. I mean, so as a guy that owned the label, you know, I've always had a secret, not a secret, but I've always had a soft spot in my heart for the band that's just almost there. Because I feel like that's the hardest place to be in, when you're like, oh my gosh, it's so close to happening, but what is it that, you know, why can't we just push it over the edge? So that's the hardest thing for me with you know, when bands work so hard and they don't get to experience the popularity that they want.
That tipping point, bro, where it makes you go, all right, boom, booyah, got there. Yeah, exactly. It's,
yeah,
so side,
you know,
one.
And all the band.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. You know. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and, you know, all the bands that we love, whether it's Rancid, you know, they all had those tipping points, Rancid, Pennywise, Bad Religion. It's like everyone has that tipping point of like, all right, you know, Bad Religion, Suffer came out, and it was just game on, you know. Rancid, you know, Out Come the Wolves, here we go. You know, it's like they had records before that were great, and then all of a sudden they make this record and it comes out. I believe it has a lot to do with timing, and it's like, you know, it's like bands, to, you know, even bands now, you know, it's like whether it's, you know, when you sign an artist, it really does come down to some magic in the universe of like, is that art going to resonate with everybody? And whether it's Lady Gaga or I'm trying to think of something that, you know, I don't know, that, what is it, the 1977,
five.
You know,
75.
Or 75, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 1975, like, you know, that's a band, like, you know, it happens and it goes huge, and there you go.
Yeah, and there you go, exactly. And so Side One Dummy's still doing good. You guys still putting out records, signing
bands?
Yeah,
I mean, for us, you know, this year, you know, the thing that we had to do and that every label, you know, has to do is, you know, to stay in the game, you have to, you know, figure out, all right, what's our core business? What are people into? What do people like about the label? What do we put out there? What's our connection with the public? And right now, you know, we have this artist named Nocco Baron, Medicine for the People. Shoot, you know, he just did Red Rocks, you know, super cool.
Wait, what's his name again? What's the name again?
Nocco Baron, Medicine for the People.
All right.
Yeah, and he's like, he was raised, like I always say, you know, I've heard the term like spiritual punk, because like he's, you know, he's been raised in Hawaii and raised here and raised in Portland. He has a really super cool story, and he's all about a higher power, and his music has the energy and connection of like no different than like, you know, than like I would say, It's not punk rock and sounding, but it definitely connects in that unity way where people just, you know, when him and the band hit the stage, it's just a full on, whether it's 1,000 people or 10,000 people, it's like everyone all on the same page, all in the same moment, which is pretty amazing to watch. It reminds me of the same thing Flogging Molly did, the same thing Gaslight Anthem could do, you know, just take a room full of people, you know, whether it's 1,000 or 2,000, make it feel like you're the only person there because their music just resonates so deeply with you. And Nocco definitely has that ability. And so I'm super psyched on him. And then we have a lot of young artists that we've just signed and started working with, and records are getting ready for to be made for next year.
Awesome, dude. That's rad. Keep it going, bro. Don't stop, man. I know you're not going to stop.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been doing it 25 years, so.
Yeah,
you know,
dude. Keep
the trip.
Keep pushing, man. I mean, like I said, you're multi-talented. I briefly want to, before, and the last thing I want to talk about is your comedy, because I know that's really like what you've been putting your heart and soul into. But I want to comment, you were also a radio host for a little bit, weren't you? Complete Control Radio?
Yeah, I did.
You do that?
Yeah, I did radio. I started radio about, let me see, I would say I started radio 16 years ago. And I started on a station in L.A. called Indy 103.1, which was super cool. It was like Steve Jones from the Pistols. You had Dave Navarro from Jane's Addiction. You had Dickie Barrett from the Mighty Mighty Boxstones. Henry Rollins was on there. And the station was really this eclectic moment in time that they put together with all these hosts. And I was managing the Mighty Mighty Boxstones, so I was working with Dickie, and then they basically put me on the air, and they were like, hey, dude, we want to do this, like, punk rock show. And I was like, it was pre-Spotify. So back then, to hear, like, Black Flag or Elvis Costello or, the Menzingers or Lawrence Arms on the radio was like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. So I did that for, like, 10 years. I did that for 10 years, and it got syndicated. And then that led to being on this other station in L.A. called 98.7. And then from 98.7, that led to being on what's the rock station there now? I'm space.
KLS? KLS?
KLS, yeah. That led to KLOS. And then I was on KLOS. And then when I kind of started radio, that's kind of what led to doing stand-up, because I was doing radio and I really enjoyed it. And everyone was like, dude, you're funny. And then I was like, wow, I wasn't in a band at this point, and I was like, man, you know what? I've always wanted to mess around with comedy, and I'd never even been. I've been to like maybe one or two comedy shows my whole entire life, and I was always like inspired by it, but it just never was the kind of the right time to do it. I was, I was either in a band or I was fully, involved in something else. And I was like, man, I'm good at telling stories. I'm going to do like this storytelling show. So I wrote this show where I told stories, and I was doing it all around LA, and then that kind of led to the people at the Improv and this place called the Largo. They were like, dude, you should do your show there. And I was like, okay. And I remember I did it at the Improv and I really liked it. I was like, this is cool. And then the woman that ran it, this woman named Emily, she was like, hey, I love what you're doing. You should consider doing stand up. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah, come back and let's see if you can kind of do what you do in 40 minutes in like 7 or 10 minutes, which at the time I was like, how could you even tell a story in 7 minutes, or would the audience get it? And that was, dude, that was seriously 10 years ago.
Really? It's that long? It's that long ago?
Yeah, I always say it's like a blessing and a curse, but I fully got bit by the stand up bug. And then now it's like, I've been doing stand up. I've been doing stand up every week for 10 years in January. Like every single, other comics, are doing, 3 and 5 spots a night, but I've been, juggling Side One Dummy, being a parent, being married and every other responsibility in life. But at the same time, I've been, getting up every single week, between 2 and 3 times a week to do stand up, and I really love it, and it really turned into like a full passion of mine, and that's definitely something that I love. Like, it's just, I was doing stand up this week in Santa Cruz, and doing spots this week. It's just something I got fully addicted to it, and it just turned into this thing where like I just love doing it so much. And and then I got a huge break where I opened up for a comedian named Jim Brewer from the East Coast, and he took me on the road for like 2 years, and that led to him and I being the opening act for Metallica's last
tour of the state. What I want to talk about. You were Metallica last tour of the States, but it's not their last tour. It's just
it's not their last tour. It's just the last. It was the most recent leg of the United States.
How long was it?
6 months.
Okay. So Metallica is one of my all-time favorite bands, and probably a lot of people listening too. It's like, oh my God, Metallica! But what was it like, dude? Tell us about this.
Oh, dude, it was insanity because, we're not a band. It was me and another comic, and the thing was that, I just fell into it because it was such a classic case of being in the right place at the right time. Jim Brewer you know, for those people listening that know him, you know his history. But for the people that don't, you know, Jim Brewer is a metalhead to the bone. He was on Saturday Night Live in the early 90s. He's an amazing impressionist. He's an amazing storyteller. But his passion is metal. And he became friends in the 90s with Lars and James from Metallica. They all ran together, and they were bros. They're like bros like you and I are. Just like, dude, what's up? And while I was on tour with Jim, he would always be like, oh, hey, man, you know, you get on the phone. And, you know, he's like, oh, I was just talking to James. And I would be like, no way, like, you're bros with James from Metallica. That's gnarly. I remember once we were on tour driving through Vail, and, like, we went to James's house. And it was just like, no, fuck, like, this is your bro, you know? And it was just
so
sick. Yeah, it was great. But once again, dude, I was just on the sideline being the guy opening for Jim. But then what ended up happening was, you know, at a certain point, Jim got asked, like, by Lars and James. They were like, hey, man, we don't want to bring an opening act on the tour because, you know, the Metallica guys, they're so into music and they're so into their fans, but they were bummed because, you know, unfortunately, when an opening act would come on the road, a lot of times the fans wouldn't come in to support the opening act, and Lars and James and the band would get bummed because they're like, dude, you know, we want people to see these bands that we're into, but unfortunately they wait outside and they just want to come in and see us, and it's a bummer for everyone, which I always thought was super cool, you know, that they were that aware of what was going on. And then what ended up happening was they talked to Jim, and they were just like, dude, what do you think about it? You came out, Brewer, and, like, did, like, an opening show. And at the time, dude, I was just like, wow, man, I'm just stoked if he says yes, because I'll get to go see, you know, I'll get to see Metallica, you know?
Exactly.
And then he said yes, and then, you know, I was still on the road with Jim, and I had no idea that I would be going. And then as he kept kind of setting it up, we would talk about different ideas, and then at a certain point, he's like, dude, you know, they told me I could bring someone with me to, you know, to help with this thing. Like, what do you think? And I was like, are you serious? And there was a part of me that was, like, hesitant at first. Like, I actually said no. I was like, oh, yeah, dude, I don't know, you know, and I remember I told my wife that, and she was just like, what are you doing? Dude, call him right now and tell him that, you know, you were high. And I was just like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, so I called him back, and I was like, dude, I'm in, I'll do it. Like, let's do it. And
hell yeah.
I didn't even know what I was getting myself into, dude, to be honest with you, because, I mean, at the time, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm a Metallica fan, grew up with the band, you know, I'm from the Bay Area. It's like, you know,
right.
I saw them on the Injustice for All tour. I used to see them at punk shows, hanging out in the 80s. You know, like, I knew the magnitude. I thought I knew the magnitude of it until I showed up in Madison, Wisconsin for the first show, and there's 23,000 people, and I'm on the stage with Jim, and I'm like, holy shit, what did we get ourselves into?
Crazy.
And, you know, I always say, like, you know, the show itself, you know, it went, you know, like, we really developed a killer show together that we ended up touring, and we did 35 shows. And, you know, at the beginning, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, you know, not so rad. You know, people that were there, like, it's funny, I meet people all the time. I'm like, dude, I was at that first show. That was gnarly. You know, I can't believe you guys figured it out. You know, we survived. I used to say to Jim, opening for Metallica every night was like dismantling a bomb, except you're dismantling it in front of 23,000 people with them, like, in your face. Like, if you play one wrong song, say one wrong thing, it explodes. It goes wrong really quick.
Right. Why, was it bad? Was the first show bad or something?
You know, the first show, dude, for me, you know, I mean, I've talked to people that were there, you know, obviously, and they were like, nah, dude, it's not as bad as you say. But, you know, it's another thing, you know, when you're the guy on stage trying to, you know, hold it together with your bro, and, you know, it's just, you know what it was, dude? It wasn't bad. It's just that there's no way to practice opening for Metallica in front of 23,000 people, you know? But the thing I will say is this, dude, we fucking fixed that. We fixed and retooled the whole entire show by the next day in Minneapolis. And from Minneapolis on, I mean, all I can say is this, by the end of the tour, the fans of Metallica, called black ticket holders, that go to every single show, and there's hundreds of them, and they're on the floor.
What are they called?
They're called black ticket holders. They buy one ticket, and they're allowed to go to every single show. They pay one fee, and they're able to go to every single show. They're on the floor. So, I mean, they're in your face, dude.
Wow.
They're not feeling you. They let you know. And they're from all over the world, dude. They're from, like, there's like these dudes. There's these two dudes. We call them the Vikings, dude. They're like they're straight up Vikings, dude. They work on oil rigs. They're like gnarly dudes. They're like as big as a semi, dude. And they come to the show. And then you have all these dudes from Brazil. And then you have all these dudes from Sweden. And then you have all these people from the States. And it's, dude, there's hundreds of them, and they're gnarly, dude. They're gnarly, like. They're in your grill, man, because they go to every Metallica show. And if they're not feeling you, dude, they let you know, dude. And all I'll say is this. By the end of the tour, dude, I'll never forget it, dude. After 35 shows and 6 months of traveling, and they were there. By the end of the tour, dude, they gave Jim and I plaques. They went out and made plaques for us. And then one group from Brazil gave us a photo book. And, like, everyone signed it, dude. I mean, I was crying, dude, the last night.
Whoa.
These people that are bonded together by metal, bonded together by Metallica, and bonded together and travel and just love this band. I mean, they brought us into their family and treated Jim and I, and they were so amazing. And the reason they said it was they were like, dude, we saw what you guys went through that first night, and we couldn't believe that you turned it around so quick, and that you and Jim, you know, and Jim, I mean, I owe it all to Brewer because, you know, he was the guy. It's like, my bit of that whole tour, sure, you know, like, you know, I'd be lying if I said, yeah, dude, fucking, I was out there. I was, you know what it was, dude, Brewer, he was doing 45 minutes of stand-up every night, crushing it. You know what it was? My point was, I was the quarterback utility guy. You know, like, and this is the thing that was great about Jim. Jim would come up with an idea at noon, and then we'd facilitate it by that night at 7 o'clock. Jim and I would come up with an idea the night after the show, you know, on the bus, and we would make it happen the next day. And the thing that I loved about it was it really allowed me to, it's like everything I ever worked for as a comic, but more importantly as, like, a dude in the band, more importantly, as a dude at Side One Dummy, like, all of those things really came into play. And it was, like, all of my, I don't want to say, it sounds kind of hokey, but, like, all of my talents and all of my strengths, they all came to being used on that Metallica tour, because I was, you know, I was the guy running the music, I was the guy, like, you know, like, all right, Jim, do this, or, you know, Jim, have it, you know, like, hey, I want to do this idea, all right, let me get to production and make it happen. Or, you know, even sometimes, you know, Jim would come up with an idea and I'd have to be like, you know, he'd do it one night and I'd be like, I don't know, dude, not feeling it. And the credit I'll give to Jim was he never, ever put his ego into it, because quite frankly, dude, he could have been like, hey, dude, check it out. I'm Jim Brewer and you're Joe Who. And, hey, check it out, dude. Lars and James aren't coming in the dressing room to hang with you. They're coming to hang with me. So why don't you keep your ideas to yourself?
Yeah, shut up, asshole. Shut up.
Dude, he was the opposite. And that's what makes an artist amazing, someone like him. He was like all day long, you know, every day, every night. Dude, that was rad. What do you think about this? I don't know, dude. I think that part's hokey. You do? All right, let's not do it. You know, he would listen to me with my ideas, which, you know, not that I, you know, was like, you know, directing him around, but it was just, you know, dude, I'll just say, man, it was a collaboration. Dude, you know what it reminded me of, to be totally honest with you, dude? It reminded me of being in a band, but I wasn't the singer. Jim Brewer was the singer, and I was more of the drummer. I had to keep the fucking beat going and keep it running tight, because if not, as we know, when you're a singer, you're in the eye of the storm, and you know, you start going off, and you start doing this, you start doing that. You know, all of a sudden, you can, you know, find yourself in a position that you're like, oh, shit, how do I get out of this? And my gig on that tour, and the reason it really worked was I knew my place, dude. I wasn't trying to, you know, go out there and fucking, you know, hot dog it and be like, oh, dude, I'm going to bust chokes or I'm going to do this. It was like, I had my moment, you know. And the one thing, too, that was pretty fucking insane was, you know, I'm out on this tour, dude. Like I said, Jim could have been like, hey, dude, no need for you to ever be on stage. He totally, you know, he incorporated me into the show in a big way that, I mean, all I can say is this. He incorporated me into the show in such a big way that, you know, in 2 weeks, Metallica is playing with the San Francisco Symphony at the brand new grand opening of their San Francisco, like where the Warriors are going to play and like all this amazing shit. And the black ticket holders for Metallica are flying in from all over the world, and they have an event that's like Ray Burton, Cliff Burton's dad is going to be there, like two of these Metallica tribute bands, all these people that have worked with Metallica, like they're having this full on event in between the two shows, and I'm like opening. They want, you know, they're like, dude, we, basically it's funny, they're like, dude, just come out and tell all of your story of, you know, opening for Metallica, because, you know, a lot of it is pretty funny looking back on it now. And I never in my wildest dreams, you know, thought that like I would be a part of that, you know, like it really was amazing. And to this day, man, like every show that I've done since opening for Metallica with Jim, you know, and on Jim's end, it's insane. He went to Europe and like fans were like coming to his shows because they're Metallica fans. And they're like, dude, we heard about you opening for Metallica. But for me, on a much, you know, smaller level, like there's always 5 or 6 or 10 people that are like, dude, we're Metallica fans, and that's how we found out about you. And I'm like, really? And I'm like, wow.
Wow, that's cool.
And it's like, you know, no, dude, it's amazing. Like, I was in a show in Irvine, California, and it was like, there was like, you know, close to like 30 people that, you know, came up to me individually, and they're like, hey, man, you know, we were Metallica fans, and, you know, we follow them on this, or we follow them on that, and we saw, you know, and then we, you know, we're fans of Jim Brewer, and we heard about you, and, it, you know, so it's, dude, it's been a game changer for me. And it's, and also, dude, I gotta say, the best thing about it, and I'll just say is this, dude, is that, you know, I went out and I had the opportunity to open up for Metallica, and if you would have told me when I was a kid, you're going to open for Metallica, I would have thought, you know, I'm going to open with my band, dude. We're going to be coming out, open with my band. If you would have told me, no, dude, you're going to be DJing and, you know, like, hosting and comedy, I would have been like, you're high. Like, there's no way that's going to happen. and to look, you know what I'm saying? I would have been like, and to look back on it now, I'm so proud of it because we did it. And we did it well, and people enjoyed it. And the other thing is, too, dude, is just like, you know, it's like, that was a moment in time that no matter what, you know, good luck to anyone else that ever does it. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
You know, it was, I feel like I'm so proud of it.
Dude, I would be opened up for, like, the raddest band ever, bro. Come on, like, I mean,
oh,
Metallica,
yeah.
Like,
dude,
come on,
just,
Metallica.
Dude,
like,
it was just,
fuck.
Yeah, it was just, and dude, you got to remember, the opening act was just me with a computer and Jim Brewer. That's it.
Yeah, because you told me before you'd come out, you wouldn't just start cracking jokes right away. You'd kind of like get the crowd to kind of on your side,
no,
kind of like chant.
My old gig was just to get everyone hyped at the beginning. But the other thing was, is that I think what saved my ass was like, you know, I knew as a kid growing up that if there was two guys that would have came out to open for Metallica, you know, comedian, I would have been the first dude to grab a beer and throw it at him. So I always, in the back of my head, was able to kind of go, all right, what can I do? Like, I knew, you know, I just knew in my head, this, you know, this can go south really quick. So, I played to that 15-year-old kid in my head.
Right.
Like, you know, I don't want to be overindulgent. I don't want to be in their face. I don't want to be disrespectful. But I did know that, like, look, man, we're all here tonight to see the fucking greatest band in the world. So
right.
I'm gonna play some music right now that I know you're gonna stoke on. And the thing was, dude, you know what the crowd wanted to hear? The crowd wanted to hear Slayer. The crowd wanted to hear Anthrax. The crowd wanted to hear Dropkick Murphys, dude. The crowd wanted to hear, you know, Adolescence. The crowd wanted to hear, you know, Every Night, dude. AC/DC. The crowd wanted to hear Motorhead, dude. And it was like, that is my, those are all my jams. So, you know, I ended up becoming their friend really quick because they were like, dude, this guy's playing the jams we like. Like, dude,
right.
I would play Dropkick Murphys and the place would go nuts.
That's fucking rad. You know, hey, I saw Metallica back in like 1990 and the opening band was a good band. I mean, I like them, The Cult. But, you know what, dude? The whole time, it was like, even back then, bro, we're talking, I think it was 1990, 89 or 90, something around that time.
No, I remember The Cult
opening.
And
they basically just like, were like, the crowd was like, not having it. Period. Not at all. Like, no, we want Metallica only, you know? So,
yeah,
it's a tough gig to open up for that band. I couldn't imagine doing comedy at first. Like, what?
Dude, and check it out, dude. I'll tell you right now. Now, you know, like I keep saying, and it's important for everyone listening to the show, you know, listening to us right now, like, dude, Jim Brewer not Joseph, Jim Brewer was carrying the weight of that show on his shoulders. And it's, and I'm telling you right now, there's no other comic that I can think of, and I'm not saying this because, you know, Jim's my bro, and he's, you know, he's my friend, but I'm just saying right now, dude, I'll tell you right now, I don't think any other comic that I know of could go out and do what Jim did, because Jim, dude, you know, his upbringing is in metal. So he's coming out there, and he's doing material that only he can do, that he knows is going to resonate with those crowd, that crowd. So
right.
Jim Brewer, he's the one that, you know, he carried that thing on his shoulders. Like I said, dude, I was the drummer. I was just making sure that, like, it all ran the way it needed to, and when he threw it to me, I was there for him. Because he would do that a lot. You know, he'd be like, yo, Joe, what's going on, bud? And I'd have to be ready, you know, I'd have to be ready to go. You know, hey, Joe, dude, you got any drop kicks? Yeah, bro, let's do this. Boom, you know. Or, hey, Joe, I want to hear some fucking Maiden right now. Got it. Yo, Joe, you know, like, he was always, you know, hey, man, what kind of requests are you getting tonight, Joe? So I was kind of his Ed McMahon.
Got it. Well, you know? It worked, dude, and I'm stoked for you guys, man.
Yeah, but, dude, I'll tell you, man, Jim, oh, my God, dude, he went out there, and he, you know, I mean, dude, he was hanging it out there, dude. I used to always laugh, dude. It was like, he was hanging it out there, like, it's like, you know, when you see, like, the president or one of these guys, like, you're like, oh, dude, man, like, there's the Secret Service just in case someone takes a shot at them. It's like, Jim was hanging it out there, dude. No Secret Service. No one protecting him. It's like, people could have shot an arrow at him from the fucking balcony, and, you know, he would have to take it. And, dude, he, you know, he has a joke that he always tells on stage now about opening for Metallica. It's like, hey, have you ever seen the guy at the circus, you know, the lion tamer? That's how it was opening for Metallica, because he had to really tame those lions, dude. All 23,000 of them. Yeah.
That's
but it was
insane.
Awesome. It was great. I loved doing it. I got a lot, but, yeah.
No, dude, go. I'm stoked for you. Well, listen, it's been rad talking to you, bro. I'm super stoked for you. Are you going to guys go? Just asking you. Have they asked you maybe to come back next year, do the Metallica gig again, or?
You know what? It was funny. It was not funny, but, you know, Jim and I was talking to Jim about it, and, you know, at first, you know, we were all like, oh, my God, dude, that was, you know, wouldn't it be amazing to keep going and wouldn't do this? And then, a couple weeks ago, Jim and I were doing shows, and, you know, we were talking about it, and, you know, just like, oh, my God, you know. And then at one point, you know, Jim just said, you know what, man, like, he kind of was like, I don't think you can ever really, he kind of was like, I don't know if you could ever really do that again. Like, it was like, I don't know, like, I mean, hey, I'm not saying that it, you know, it couldn't happen again, but there is a part of me that's like, I mean, I can't speak for him, but, like, it was so, I don't know, dude, it's like, I guess I could share, I mean, for you, it'd be like, you know, it'd be like, all right, you know how, like, there's the loop, you know, how Tony Hawk does the loop on the skateboard, you know, the full loop?
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, let's say, you know, has anyone ever done that on a bike?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of guys have.
Okay. Have you?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So let's use that as an example. So let's say you train, and you're like, dude, you just had a hard-on. You're like, I don't know, dude. I have to be able to do this loop before I call it a day. So let's say you go and you train and you train and you train, and then, you know, one day you're like, all right, camera's rolling, let's do this. And you bust the loop, right? Like, if you busted it and made it, and then after you were done, I said to you, and let's say, you know, you do it once, you do it twice. Like, you know, you do it 3-4 times that day. You can, and, you know, you definitely, it's not like a fluke where you just did it and you're like, all right. Like kind of like Metallica. I opened up for him for 35 times, and, you know, I was part of it with Jim, and I still have my teeth, and my face looks the way it does, and it's okay. Like, I survived. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
I don't, would you, it's kind of like the loop, man. Like, if I said to you the next day, yo, Rick, do you want to go back and do the loop? Would you? Or would you say, you know what, I don't know, man. I did it, but I don't know if I need to put myself in that position again. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get it. And plus, also, too, each time you tour, it's like the first time round's rad, second time could be kind of, third time's like, all right, we want something different. We're over this shit now.
I mean,
like,
dude, and how about this?
You know what I mean?
And how about this, dude? I'll just say this, dude. Like, I mean, Metallica was so cool to us. I mean, dude, those guys, oh, my God. I mean, like, I could do an hour on just Metallica. Like, the thing I was so impressed with all of them is, like, James Hetfield is no different off the stage than he is on stage, except for one thing. Like, off of stage, he wears, like, maybe a black Motorhead shirt, and then on stage he just wears a black shirt. That's like the only difference. And a cowboy hat off stage. Like, you don't have a cowboy hat off stage cruising around. They took such good care of us that, I don't know, man. I mean, you know, hey, man, I'm not going to say, you know, no. I mean, dude, it was an amazing event, and it was amazing. But I will say, there was something special for those 35 shows, and I felt really, I know everyone uses this word, and hashtag grateful, but I'll be honest, man, I am so grateful that Jim Brewer brought me on the road with them, and I'm so grateful that I got to use, you know, all the stuff that, you know, over my life that was able to help it make it rad. But dude, I'll tell you this right now, man, it was just all about being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, but dude, listen, it is, but it's also this. You're talented, you're multi-talented, and you're also a likable dude. Okay, and you get the work done, you got great energy, and people like to be around you. And all of that's important, too. Nobody likes to be around someone that's Debbie Downer, you know what I mean?
No, you're right.
You got good energy, hey, you've always had good energy, and people like you, and they talk good about you when you're not around. You'll say, oh, that's Joe, oh yeah, he's cool as hell, he does this. People remember that shit, dude, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I always say, any advice I'd give anyone that's listening that's young is it's all about, like, it's not how rad you are on stage. It's the, you know, hey man, he's cool on stage for 30 minutes. Okay, cool. But if you're a dick and tough to deal with the other 11 and a half hours of the day, it's like, dude, tell this dude to fucking bail.
Kick rocks. Like, you know what I mean? Later.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's the same in BMX. And like, dude, I'm stoked to talk to you too, bro. I know that you got to get going.
Oh.
We've talked for over an hour. Go surf. Hopefully there's still some waves there. Real quick.
I'm looking at it right now.
Go get it. Okay, what's your Instagram for yours and Side One Dummy so people listening
can
follow
you? All you got to do is this. Go to Side One Dummy, and it's just Side One Dummy Records. Everyone will see that one. Yeah, follow us on there. And then, hey, man, follow me on Instagram, Joe_Sib, S-I-B, B as in boy, S as in Sam, I-B, Joe_Sib. All of my tour dates with comedy are always up there. And then, hey, anyone listening, man, and you're like, hey, dude, I want to ask you a question. You know, I got a band. Hey, man, blah, blah, blah. Just give me an email, dude. It's super simple. It's joesib, all one word, 22@gmail. joesib, 22, the number, at Gmail. Hit me up, man. And,
yeah.
I hope that everyone else has a great day. And I'm going to go get some waves.
All right, brother. Thanks a lot for your time. Much love and stay rad.
Later, brother. You stay rad.
All right, for sure. Later, dog.